Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Amy Ryan. Entire life story, but I did want to ask you a little bit about getting into acting. You were a student at the, what's known, I guess, as the Fame School, the School of High School of Performing Arts. Is that true?
Yes, P.S. Fame. Yes.
Okay.
I went to the High School of Performing Arts, which is now called LaGuardia, for 3 years and studied theater there.
And what got you into that? I mean, what I always wonder about people who decide to go into acting, because I've had the same job for 25 years, and I can't imagine being in a life where you are always looking for the next job and dealing with constant rejection and failure along the way to success. So, like, how did you decide you wanted to go into this?
Well, I didn't know about the constant rejection when I, you know, set out at the age of, you know, 11 in my backyard making plays in the neighborhood. But I didn't know of the movie at the time, but my mother had heard about the school had suggested it to me because I had shown an interest at an early age and gone to a theater camp and, you know, pretty much annoyed my family, imitating them and such, being a pain in the ass. So she said, you need to go focus this energy. So that's, she's the one who brought my attention to the school.
Right. And so but you worked primarily in theater for the first part of your career.
I started in theater, and I'm very grateful for that because I would have learned, or I would have acquired bad habits, I think, had I gone straight to California. But and I only started in theater because that was the first job I got. Had I gotten a TV movie of the week, I would have, you know, woohoo! I didn't know any better, so I was really appreciative that my first job was a Neil Simon play.
And which play was it?
It was Biloxi Blues, and I toured the country for nine months, a month out of high school.
Now you've said that Streetcar Named Desire was an incredibly important, I mean, of course you got a Tony nomination for that, but you said it was an incredibly important play for you, just the influence of that play on you. Could you talk about that?
I love that play. It's pretty obvious why. It's I think the greatest play, American play. And I carried that play around in my back pocket for 8 years, just saying, one day I want to play Stella, I want to play Stella. And then I had met Patricia Clarkson. We were doing an Arthur Miller play in Williamstown. And I said, have you ever thought about playing Blanche? And her eyes lit up. And together for 8 years, we tried to track the rights. But they were always tied up in London. Mm-hmm. And eventually, it was truly just happenstance that Gary Hines acquired the rights to do it down at the Kennedy Center, and Patricia and I did the production there. And then a year later, I did it on Broadway with the late Natasha Richardson.
Were there actresses, either at screen or theater, that you admired a lot or sort of watched and saw as maybe role models or inspirations?
Well, as a kid, my biggest influences as a kid was Carol Burnett and The Muppet Show. I really mean that.
Mine too, but it didn't get me anywhere.
And my mother always said, because my beginning part of my career, really up until The Office, was always these heavy dramas, Uncle Vanya, and,
right,
you know, or I was always crying. My friends call me Crying Ryan. But she said, your career always surprised me. I thought for sure you'd be in comedy. But I think once I went to school and learned a thing or two, and that comedy's actually harder, I was just drawn to drama, and I had teachers who said, study life, you know, as you take the train in, just study life. If you don't know their story, make it up. And I was just really just drawn to just real life.
If you sort of file things away, we did a discussion with Michael Caine, and he told a number of stories about just observing people, just watching people and making notes and filing away things that he would use later on. So were you consciously doing
that? Yeah, I've used a lot of my friends and family along the way. Mm-hmm. None for Gone Baby Gone. I can't help but absorb that stuff, even if it's just the way someone holds their head up, or if I can take myself out of myself when I'm working, it's easier for me. I'm less self-conscious along the way. So if I can think of someone else, be it a stranger or someone very familiar, it really helps.
The first role that drew the attention of a big audience, I think, was The Wire, working that series. Now you were a fan, I guess, of The Wire before you were cast in it, right? Were you just watching it in the first season?
Yeah,
because you entered it in the second season.
That's correct. I watched it in the first season, was a huge fan, and then was cast for the second season. And my first day on set, I had a scene with Lance Reddick, Lieutenant Daniels, and was completely sky high with my lines. I was so flummoxed being in his presence. He's so steely on that show, such strength, and in life he's really goofy, and I couldn't marry the two. It threw me.
Well, it must have been weird to be all of a sudden be in the world of a show that you have watched and you've entered into that.
It's very off-putting, but that quickly fades.
Yeah. And, we'll see a scene from it, then we can talk a bit more about it. So actually, the scene that we're going to see is not from season two, but from season five, and it's a scene that's really pivotal. I think we'll just let it speak for itself, so, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. So let's go with the first clip.
All the guys at the bar, Jimmy. All the girls, they don't show up at your wake. You're not because they don't like you, but because they never knew your last name. And a month later, someone tells them, oh, Jimmy died. Jimmy who? Jimmy the cop? Oh, they say, him. And all the people on the job, all the people you spent all those hours in the radio car with, the guys with their feet up on their desk telling stories, who shorted you on the food runs, who signed your overtime slips. In the end, they're not going to be there either. Family, that's it, family. And if you're lucky, one or two friends who are the same as family. That's all the best of us get. Everything else is just...
There is no serial killer. There are no murders. I made it all up. They were shoving us down. They were just... It's hard to explain. I don't even know where the anger comes from. I don't know how to make it stop. They fucking task me. They do. We took the money from the bullshit investigation. We routed it to Lester. Now he's got the cake to take down Marlo Stanfield. And now that I've done all this, and now that I've watched myself do it, I can't even stand it. Lester says he's close. Time will pass, and I'll be able to shut this thing down.
If you don't go to jail. You had no fucking right.
I know.
This is my life, too.
You start to tell the story, you think you're the hero, and then when you get done talking, you...
Can you talk a bit about Beattie? She's such an important character because she is kind of... a moral compass for the audience, and the show is so complicated over the five seasons, what happens to all these characters.
One thing I love about David's writings and the character he's created for The Wire is not one character is truly the good guy or the bad guy. And even though Beatty has the most morals of any character on that show, perhaps, she... The first time you meet her, she's really not good at her job. She's a port police officer, but she's doing her rounds wearing headphones. She's not listening to the radio. She knows it's a dead-end job. She's completely checked out. So it's not until she's, forced into this investigation later on that she gains this confidence and therefore also gains pride in her work for the first time. And then as the seasons went on, she became this love interest for McNulty, who is just the worst man anyone could ever get involved with. But she gets him on the straight and narrow, and I think that's one thing she doesn't mess when it comes to her family. And,
I think this episode was written by Dennis Lehane.
That's right, that's true. Dennis Lehane, who wrote the book For Gone to Be Gone.
Yeah, I mean, just an amazing... So, I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but just the experience of working The Wire, I mean, I'm one of the people who believe it's the greatest show, the dramatic series that's ever been on television.
I mean, I'm very proud that they teach The Wire at Harvard and Tulane. It's definitely beyond entertainment. I feel like it's a beautiful look. It's a social study, really, of our city.
What was it like being sort of in and out of the show over the five episodes? Because characters would come in as needed and then disappear for
long stretches. David had a formula where every five episodes someone died, whether they were a passerby or a beloved character. And we showed an episode in season two down in New Orleans at the Essence Music Festival for same idea, like a screening audience who were getting a first look. And I don't know. In case any of you here haven't seen it, I won't ruin it, but a very beloved character, lead character, died. And the reaction was so astounding. I've never experienced this. They were stomping their feet and screaming at the screen, no, no. And they were pissed off at us afterwards. They wanted us to go and reshoot it. They wanted that character back. But the beauty of David's writing is story comes first, no matter what, doesn't matter what actor or character has the most hits on the web page, or he doesn't write that way.
And what was it like in terms, I mean, he comes from a journalism background, from a nonfiction background, made a number of documentaries. What was it like in terms of the work of the actor in that series, in terms of preparation and research?
Exactly. You can ask anything of him. He has just Oracle. Really, he's deeply intelligent, and it was having just the dramaturg and the writer, the right there on set at all times. But and he just cares so deeply about that city. So he always said too that he goes, no actor will ever be famous for my show. You won't ever have a spin-off career or anything like that, which maybe typical TV can do for other actors. He said, but I promise you, you'll have work.
Right. Well, get some work. Right. I mean, one of the things that this has employed a lot of African American actors is probably the best series in terms of showcase for just in terms of the writing and roles that were available for all these different actors. And it led to it did lead to some work for you, right?
there was a chance I was going to be on. For the remaining 4 years, every day. And at the end of the second year, David said, it's not going to work out that way, but we'll have you peppered in through the last 3 years. And I was deeply disappointed, because I was having such a great time. But then that led the way for just being available for other jobs. So had he not done that, I wouldn't have got to do Streetcar, wouldn't have got to do, I guess it would have been It's Gone, Baby Gone at that time as well.
Yeah.
So change is good.
So how did that role, I mean, that's obviously such a pivotal role for your career, but how did Gone, Baby Gone come about? And then what was, the next question, of course, is, I guess, when you read this, either the book or the script for the first time and see the character that you're going to play.
My agent, Jason Gutman, who's here tonight, I just started working with him for a few months at that time, and I was going out to LA to try to get a TV series, but the first script he sent me was Gone Baby Gone, and apparently Ben Affleck already had an actress in mind, and the casting director said it probably won't happen, but he kept pushing to get me in, and he got me an appointment finally, and then after that first meeting, he had asked, you know, where was I from Boston? What town was I from?
Oh, okay, that's good. That's a good sign.
I said, oh, I'm from Queens. He came around the table and he hugged me and kissed the top of my head. He said, great. He said, I want you to do this.
So what have you done to pull that off, to get to do? Because I heard that you've did a lot of work on the accent and the voice.
I spent summers in Vermont as a kid, and that Boston accent was nearby, although not obviously local to Vermont, but so I had the gist of it down, and I also think there's a similar attitude that Queens can have, that lower class, working class Queens. So I think I had the hip stance. And then when I got to Boston, I never left the woman in the movie who plays my friend, Jill Quigg, who's not an actress. She actually broke through security on set one day and asked Ben for a part, not that nicely. And I never left her side, just to hear her voice, and also just hanging with the Teamsters.
Yeah. What was your response to the character? How did you sort of, I mean, certainly not a instantly sympathetic character, to say the least, that you played?
I relished it. I loved it. I loved her. She's a despicable human being, but I know enough not to judge a character I'm playing. I don't have to condone them outside my life, their behavior, but if I judge them, I'll be sunk. So it's starting to ask questions, backing up, how did she get to this situation? You know, was she the same child? Did she have the same mother that, you know, I became in the movie? And so I throw a lot of compassion at it first, and the stuff that I can't figure out, I just get out of its way. Dennis wrote it for a reason, and that's what needs to be said. And so then just that language, it's obviously very salty, but it's also very colorful. She has a great imagination, and that's so rare. And as an actor, if you get that.
Well, she uses language to get a reaction. I mean, she has fun with it.
Yeah. She knows she gets a rise out.
And then I think another thing that's there, because it's not thought of as a comedy by any means, but there is an element of playfulness or comedy. So I want to show a clip. Let's do the next clip from Gone Baby Gone. Number two, I give that you.
Scott Flaherty, didn't you?
How do you know?
You know, at the St. Mark's. I was a freshman when you were a senior. You don't remember me?
No.
Whatever happened to Scott?
He stabbed a foreign exchange student in the chest. He got life and welcome. He's a faggot now.
He's kind of a faggot in high school.
Oh, man. You're terrible. He was cute.
He kind of wore them tight shorts.
Oh, who's a faggot now? You're dating a faggot.
So how'd the money end up in Chelsea? I thought you and Ray went home after.
No, we dropped off Amanda and went back to Ray's. The fucking retarded Ray left his baby rock in my place. You know, right then I'm like, I'm gonna drop this motherfucker. I don't care if he does got a big dick. So we went back to the apartment. And Ray was hollering, he's gonna wake up Amanda. She needs her sleep, you know? So we went back to Ray's mother's, whatever. Yeah. I don't know where that mother went, but she left all her fucking cats in there, and it smells like cock.
She's never contacted you, never left you a note?
No, we didn't hear nothing from Cheese. That's why Ray said don't say shit.
You didn't think it was worth it for your daughter's sake to tell people what happened? Cheese has your kid. Fucking knows what he's doing to her.
What am I gonna do? Call Cheese and be like, ah, you got my daughter? Because I just ripped you off and I'm just checking.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh, I'm gonna call the cops too and be like, you know, just so you know, I want to know I run coke and heroin, in case that's irrelevant.
All right, calm down. What makes you think Ray hasn't spent all the money on you?
Nigga, please, I hit it. Pull over.
Do you remember shooting that scene? I wonder how what it's like to shoot in a car like that.
Yeah, we did about 8 loops around the block with a bunch of local kids that, as seen in the movie, they're yelling out similar language to Ben Affleck. But I do remember that in between, as the car was getting back round to the starting point, we would run lines again. And actually, I owe a lot to Casey in that, because we were playing around in between, and we started improvising a little bit. And actually, that moment of when I teased Michelle Monaghan that you're dating a faggot.
Right.
So, and there was just a real playfulness, and he said, you should do that in the scene. I said, no, I shouldn't. I should stick to the script. He goes, do it. I said, let me ask Ben first. He goes, no.
Oh, the brother's allowed to direct? Yeah.
What's he gonna do? He's my brother, don't worry. It was very playful.
And now you've worked with a number of first-time directors. So what was it like working with Ben Affleck in this film? I mean, he's now sort of establishing himself as a director.
Yeah, there's, Ben said straight up, he said, it may turn out I don't know how to direct. It may turn out I'm going to get in trouble for casting my brother. And but I do know one thing. I know Boston, and I'm so tired of seeing Boston depicted in film, you know, as Pocky Khan Hamadiyad, you know, the whole, just so exaggerated. So we also, I think together, there it felt conspiratorial. I knew I had this great part that a lot of people wanted, and there was a danger to obviously get it wrong, and Ben, his, you know, the stakes for him were very high. So there was a real camaraderie to stick together. And then also that character, I feel like each director, if it's theater or film, there's always one character that they love more than any other one. And I've been on the other side of that, where the director is, you know, more inspired to you know, rip apart that character and get it deeper. And clearly, you know, Ben had that with this character.
Well, yeah, it's so clear that that's what people responded to. And we all know what happened to the film and the response to your performance, but did you have a sense that that was going to happen while you were making it?
Oh, absolutely. Not. Yeah. No, that's it's like the furthest thing,
right,
you know, from my mind. So at that time, once that had happened in the Oscars, it's just a snowball, you know, it's quite something different. Mm-hmm. But there, when you're working and it's hot and it's summer, you're a month in Boston, it's we were just really thinking about that.
Yeah. And were there things that you sort of latched onto about the character that made, I mean, one thing we see in this scene is sort of getting a sense of what she's like in high school and the choices she's made. It gives some understanding of sort of how she turned out.
Yeah.
How she did.
The character. Yeah. And I think she's actually really smart. You know, what she says with the car there, you know, she's got street smarts. She knows how that game is played. But it's true. You know, I don't think people change drastically. You know, maybe the pendulum swings really far, but it always settles back in maybe a 2 to 3 degree difference. Mm-hmm. So by the end of this film, you know, I know a lot of people were really angry at me via the character, you know, or the character, and couldn't understand why they wanted the child to go to Casey so badly. They wanted to go to Morgan Freeman so badly.
Yeah.
That, you know, but, you know, kidnapping is wrong, even if it is Morgan Freeman who gets the baby.
Right.
It's all wrong. And not to say that, you know, Helene is the answer as well, but I hope people would ask the bigger question, like, well, how do we help our communities? Because clearly this is a cycle that needs to be broken. That's the way I saw it.
And could you tell us a little bit about the response? I mean, what it's like to be in that position of Oscar nomination and all that attention and acclaim? I mean, obviously it had a major impact on your career.
It changed my career, it did, and I'm very grateful for it. It brought better writers and better directors to my agent's desk for me, and that's a gift I will never take for granted. And then the actual event itself is just pure madness, and it's kind of mind-boggling, and it's good that it ends, that you can't, you know, it's good. Actually, I was staying at the Four Seasons Hotel for a good chunk of time in LA that Miramax very, you know, generously paid for, and it was a Cinderella's life. And good morning, Miss Ryan, and welcome back, Miss Ryan. Oh, we're rooting for you, Miss Ryan, and would you like some tea, Miss Ryan? And I didn't win. The next day, we're going back home to the airport, and I'm looking at my sheet, and I can't, the car's not there, and I'm afraid to miss the flight. And I'm looking, and the valet came over, and he says, oh, let me help. I said, oh, great, thanks, okay, here. He goes, okay, what's your car number? He goes, and what's your name? And I was, I had a ting. I was like, oh, just crushed. And there's Brad Bird getting in a car with his Oscar. Tilda Swinton still drinking champagne somewhere else. But I was so grateful for that moment because I said, that's right. What's your name? Go home. Go to your family. Go to what you know. Go back to New York City because this is all temporary. This doesn't really matter.
You seem to like unpredictability in a number of ways. I think within the performances, I think you often make surprising choices, unexpected choices, and then also in your career, you certainly, because the next clip we're going to see is, we actually look at The Office. But do you have sort of an idea in mind about that?
Well, The Office, right after Gone Baby Gone, majority of scripts I got were, hey, she's a drug addicted mother of three. She's a drug addicted mother of two. It's like, oh. So we said, you know, if we can make a right angle turn, and by that it was a comedy and wearing a skirt and lipstick. And then The Office came around. So another show I was a big fan of. And
oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
So anyway, I jumped at the chance to join the show.
Yeah, I think in season four, I think we're going to see. So let's do that, even though it's number four on the menu here, but we'll, because The Office comes next, but it's before Changeling. So let's look at The Office. Romantic scene.
Damn it.
Hello, Holly. Whoa, what are you doing? You don't have to do that. I mean, we have already put together chairs. That's how we buy them, actually.
Oh, trying to adjust the lumbar support on Toby's chair, and that made this up-down lever thing not work, and then I took the whole chair apart, and that is the story of me on the floor. It's pretty good, right? I'm going to sell the movie rights.
And the sequel, Woman Stands at Desk and Works. So, I have no idea how you sit like that.
Yoga.
Sit on the floor and put together a chair? Yoda.
Pass curvy metal piece, you will.
So are you in town this weekend? Because I'm not. I'm not going to be in town. Going out of town.
Oh, so you can't make my orgy? Kidding.
Kidding.
Acting!
Love it.
Thank you.
closest for John Lovitz. Yeah. So what is it like working on a sitcom like that? I have this image of a sitcom, the creative process being first, you have like dozens of writers throwing incredibly witty lines around. Of course, The Office has so many great comedians on the cast, so I imagine there's also a lot of improvisation as well. So could you tell us what it's really like?
The show is actually, it's heavily scripted, and they really make you stick to that script. Probably at least three takes in, and then everyone, it's kind of an unspoken rule, just waits for Steve to throw down the first improv, you know, and then it kind of, it loosens up. And not that he's such a generous, lovely man. It's not that he controls a tight ship, but they just know he's going to take it to the best place. But that's, we wait for Steve.
Okay. So in that scene, were there any moments that you remember being
improv? That was actually all scripted.
Mm-hmm. And what were you, I don't know, I guess in preparing to play Holly, what was your sort of idea? It's such a delightful, like it's the perfect match for Steve, for one thing.
Yeah, it's good for every pot. But, again, that was kind of a jarring situation, because you walk into that set and it's smaller than it looks, the way you imagine on TV and all that. And I was actually very nervous, because years ago I had worked on a sitcom that was a terrible experience, and I just convinced myself I'm just not funny, and I should go home and do more plays, and that's what I did. And it wasn't until The Office, so it was nerve-wracking, but I think slowly, the more and more they were writing more preposterous scenes for her, that actually loosened me up a bit.
Is there anything about the shooting style? It's shot in a way that, of course, looks very spontaneous, a documentary style. That's sort of the but is that actually true in terms of what it feels like on the set? Like, is there more immediacy?
There are two cameramen, and they have the camera up on their shoulders, and it's all blocked out, but they will walk and move with you, and they have a bit of freedom. They do a bit of, I guess, improvising themselves. If they see something suddenly interesting, if someone is reacting in a way, they'll quick. Mm-hmm. You know, flip and turn and to capture that. So, but they're very much a part of the cast.
Since you've done actually a fair amount of television and film, could you talk at all about the difference in terms of your process?
I don't think my process changes from theater to film or TV, except that it depends on the rehearsal you get. Obviously, you get more in theater up to 4 weeks, and in film, it's very rare to get rehearsal, television as well. So television, you'll just cover more pages in a day, up to, you know, maybe 7-8 pages, where film, you'll do 3 in a day.
So how much time does it take to shoot an episode? Over how many days is an episode
of The Office? I believe they work about 7 working days, weekends off. Yeah.
So we're going to, another, change in tone, because we're going to look at a scene from Changeling next. And Clint Eastwood, I just want to hear, I'm such a fan of Clint Eastwood as a director, and he's one of the few directors who just seems to be getting better with every film. I mean, he's just grown into, I mean, I think starting, there's Mystic River, it's almost like every film since then has just been, he's sort of gained confidence and strength as a director.
It's hard to think of him as unconfident.
No, I know, but he's just the films get better and better. Yeah. So, yeah. What was it?
No actor ever gets to meet Clint in an audition process. You go on videotape with the casting director, and he'll cast you off that tape. So the first time I met Clint was, they knocked on the trailer door and said they're ready for you on set. And I walked, we were shooting on location downtown Los Angeles, and I walked the block and a half, and you see your heart's pounding, and I had my head down, and I only picked it up because I was about to bump into someone, and it was, you know, Clint Eastwood. hello. he's just iconic, and the challenge there is, how do you meet the person, not the personality or what you think that person is like. But he's actually so warm and funny. I think he knows, he understands his stature, so he brings you in straight away.
You were also, of course, working with another larger-than-life personality, a person there with Angelina Jolie, who's just,
yeah.
you know, such a...
I truly gasped when I saw her in person.
Yeah.
I truly, a very small but audible gasp.
Yeah.
But she really is that luminescent. She is
yeah.
stunning. And I found her the same, very approachable. If there's someone of that stature, I usually wait for their invite. But she was very open, and she spoke a lot about her family and her charity work. And I thought, well, yeah, that's the person who can travel the world.
Because there's so much else going on around her all the time that must
yeah.
be a little surreal.
Well,
to
there's
deal
two
with that.
There's two different things. I
yeah.
mean, there's those mega stars that have so much going around, and they just shut down and they surround themselves with assistants and their Blackberries, and then there are the ones who actually know how to say hello and have manners, and she's that.
Okay, so let's look at a scene from Changeling. You did.
I heard them talking. You're here on code 12, the police action. I mean, the doctors, the staff, they figure that if the police brought you here, there must be a good reason for it.
There isn't a good reason for it. I'm perfectly sane, and I will explain that to them.
Now, the more you try to act sane, the crazier you start to look. If you smile too much, you're delusional, you're stifling hysteria. If you don't smile, you're depressed. If you remain neutral, you're emotionally withdrawn and potentially catatonic.
You're giving this a lot of thought.
Don't you get it? You're code 12, so am I. We're here for the exact same reasons. We both pissed off the cops. You see that lady there? She's married to a cop and kept beating her up. When she tried to tell somebody about it, he brought her here. And that one? Police beat the crap out of her brother. Broke both his arms. When she tried to tell the papers,
and you?
I work nights.
Sure.
I mean, I work nights.
Oh.
My clubs. Downtown. Yeah. This one client just kept hitting me and he wouldn't stop. So I filed a complaint. Turns out he was a cop. Next thing I know, I'm here.
But they can't do that.
Are you kidding? Everybody knows women are fragile. And they're all emotions and logic. There's nothing going on upstairs. Every once in a while, they say something that's a little inconvenient. They just go fucking nuts. Pardon my French. If we're insane, nobody has to listen to us. I mean, who are you gonna believe? Some crazy woman trying to destroy the integrity of the force? Or a police officer? And once they get us in here, we either shut up, we learn to behave, or we don't go home. Or we go home like that.
So I asked about working with a first-time director. This is somebody who's directed, he's actually directed more films than Scorsese has directed at this point. And he's somebody who started making films in the 50s, in that classic days of the studio system. So is there something different about working with a director who's sort of rooted in a very old-fashioned style of filmmaking?
Well, his style of filmmaking is only similar to Sidney Lumet's in that, in my experience, you get maybe one take.
Huh.
And you rarely get, you know, rehearsal in that. They shoot so fast. These men have happy homes they want to get to. And I've had friends, it didn't happen to me, but I have other friends who work with Clint Eastwood, and I called and said, you know, what should I expect? And they said, be ready. Sometimes they do rehearsal for the cameras. Clint has, in the past, said, great, moving on. And he's filmed the rehearsal. So you really need to be on your toes and really well prepared. And he's very soft-spoken, and, you know, he really doesn't say much. I I think he...
Does he leave you to find a lot of the things, like just some of the little...
Yeah, I mean, I think he trusts the actress he cast. Because I asked the Angelina, I said, well, surely you must have had, you know, loads of meetings with him or such. And she said, no. She said, I told him I wanted to wear a wig. And he said, all right, well, we'll arrange a screen test. And you know best. You see what you like best. And then she, too, was the first day of shooting that they started talking about the part. Hmm. He just has that trust.
And did you, like, did you pick the wig or the hair? I mean, the
my hair.
Speaking of hair.
All right, I'll be really honest. That film was shot.
It was a little different tonight. So,
oh, my God. Yeah. That film was shot very close to the Oscars. And I didn't want to cut my hair. It was a bit of vanity. Because I said to the hair department, I said, What will we, you know, what will we do? And she said, well, because it's a period piece, like women have short hair, you know, there'll be a bob, but the longer haired women will have it up in the snood or something. And mine was really in between. So the woman said, oh, she says, well, why don't we make you like you have a naturally curly head of hair, and if you were out, not locked up, you would have lovely finger waves of the period. I said, great. So I go to the hair and makeup trailer in the morning, and my hair was to here. But by the time I shot, it turned into an 80s party perm. I do regret that. And it's there forever. So that's my hair.
And I didn't have a scene from the Met film, but that's a great performance also. So, and I'd love to just hear about working with him. I guess did they both? Lumet and Eastwood sort of end at 5 o'clock. Is that what you mean by?
Yeah. I never had lunch working on Changeling. I was sent home every day before lunch.
That's
how fast we shot. But Sydney's different, and we actually used. I know I'm jumping ahead, but yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman, who directed tonight's film, he found it really helpful. We're talking about Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Sydney rehearses every film like a play for 2 weeks and maps out a theater space, and there's tape on the floor, and there's furniture that'll represent. Mm-hmm. What's going to be on the day, and then you do a run through at the end of it, and his thinking behind it is we shoot so fast and out of order that when you get to that emotional scene, you'll know what it feels like, what's right, because we've already gone through it, and it all added up in the room. So Phil adopted that for Jackless Boating because he's also wearing two hats in this film. So we did that as well.
And that must be very rare in a film to have those.
Yeah,
is it a few weeks that you rehearsed?
2 weeks. Yeah. 2 weeks, same on Jacko's Boating.
Wow. Green Zone is, first of all, a whole different style of filmmaking and a really interesting story because it's obviously based on truth and based on a thinly veiled account of the New York Times and the run-up to the war. So could you talk about that? Because there you're directly involved in a film that's really portraying, it's very specific. It's not sort of a general anti-war film.
Right. Well, we started shooting Green Zone at the end of the Bush administration. And all the characters in the film are obviously thinly veiled references to real life people. But then when we went back for reshoots, I think it was 6-7 months later, it was we were on the eve of the election, and we realized we started the film. There was a lot of finger pointing and preaching to the converted, obviously. But once we realized, okay, Obama's coming in. Now what? And it very much had to have that tone, I think, of okay, well, we're in it. How do we? Yeah. Now what do we do with this mess? And how do we best clean it up rather than continue this finger pointing? So was it just interesting in terms of? Working on a film and a script and how that had shifted with the times. I'd never been involved with anything so current.
Right. And then how do you deal with the fact that the film sort of does and doesn't directly make a link between Miller, the New York Times reporter?
I play the reporter, Lori Dane. And many times I worked for the Wall Street Journal and worked for the New York Times, and we're trying to, of course, we know who it is. But, in truth, there were many reporters that got it wrong.
Yeah.
She was the most famous to get it wrong. So it was her. Actually, this one tiny thing, I saw a photograph of her and she had this chain around her neck, and clipped to it was one of those disc drives.
Mm.
And I took that. That was my little wink and nod. And so that's the only thing. But other than that, you know, we just said, this has to be a representation of all the press that got it wrong.
And before we look at this, the scene that we're going to show is not a sort of big, there's no sort of combat action scene. But what was it like being in a film that had sort of combat scenes and that sort of war action?
I've never been in a war situation, but it does get your heart pumping, even the fake situation. We were working with all of Matt's, the guys in Matt's unit, Matt Damon's unit, were actual soldiers, some who were going back for their second or third tours once we were finished filming. And suddenly, you just had to look over at them to be snapped out of this, you know, Hollywood reality.
Yeah.
And my God, you know, this is their life. And it was upsetting. It was deeply upsetting.
Okay, so let's see the last clip that we have from Green Zone. This is a scene with, of course, with Matt Damon.
I need to talk to you about Magellan.
I'm gonna call you right back. What you got?
I read your articles. You said an Iraqi WMD source named Magellan met with U.S. officials prior to the war. I need to know about that meeting.
Oh, come on, Miller. I can't discuss my sources with you.
Well, did you ever meet the guy? You know who he is?
Of course I didn't meet him. He's an Iraqi internal, for Christ's sakes.
Then how do you know what he's saying is true?
Because I made contact through a reliable intermediary.
Reliable?
Yes.
Have you ever even been to any of Magellan's sites? You ever been to Diwania? To Crit?
No.
There's nothing there. Magellan's intel is bullshit. Who's the intermediary?
No, I'm not discussing sources, Miller.
Jesus Christ, this is the reason we went to war. All right, then at least tell me how it happened. How does this happen? How does somebody like you write something that's not true? Tell me. What do you know?
Look, I got a phone call one day from a senior official in D.C. He says, I've got a story for you. The truth about Saddam's WMD programs. So I go to meet him. He puts the source report in my hands. Magellan's product, the raw intel.
But when did you check the story?
He was a senior official, for Christ's sakes. He had access to Magellan's debrief. All he asked was that I not disclose the location of the meeting.
The location?
Yes, in case I compromised the source.
It was Jordan, wasn't it? The meeting was in Jordan.
Yes.
Tough scene to play because there's so much that's going on. You know, this is a character who's like, no, she's been caught. There's so much that's going on that's not in the words that you're saying.
I tell you, Paul Greengrass works with a lot of improvising. We'll read the scene in the morning, and he'll then go away and rewrite it or such. But he'll, once you get into an actual scene, though, he asks you to improvise. I don't really want to improvise about WMD. It's one thing to improvise. The subject is love. It's universal. Everyone knows what that is. But suddenly, you know, to pull out, to improvise a character's profession that they've been at for 15 years, and as an actor you've been at for 4 weeks, is not an easy task. So I and Matt had been working on the script with Paul for a long time, so he was quite better schooled at it than I was. But I admitted to Paul Greengrass at the end, it wasn't that scene in particular, but there were others, where he said, that was you know, great, darling, great. I said, you didn't catch that? I said, no. I said, I only repeated what Matt said louder. That was my way, because I was swimming for facts and dates and to Crete and da-da-da, you know?
Yeah.
But I was, oh my God, I'm just going to be caught out here any minute now. But so yeah, just repeat what Matt said. That was my way of improvising this film.
And was there anything that you did to make yourself feel comfortable playing a journalist?
We had on that film, we had so many advisors. A lot of them were, a few were journalists who were in Iraq at the time and writing about the war before it broke out. So it was incredible just to turn to them at any moment, even to say, like, is this pad right? Would I fold it? Would I put it in this pocket? Every little detail I could turn to someone. And Rajiv Chandrasekharan, who wrote the book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, that which our script is loosely based or inspired by, he was there as well. So there was great resource all around.
Yeah, it's a terrific movie, and I think this, you know, when there was a time when a number of movies were coming out that dealt with the war that were not doing as well as the studios had hoped for, until the, I guess, the success of The Hurt Locker, which didn't even make a lot of money.
Yeah,
but what was your feeling about it?
I thought for sure they would go see Matt Damon, the action hero, but no one wants to see the subject matter, I don't really understand why, but there you have it.
Well, it's a great film, a great piece
Thank
of filmmaking.
You.
I want to ask you a little bit about Jack Goes Boating without spoiling any of it for you, but we'll take a break in a few minutes, and then you'll all get to see this wonderful film that you made with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And, you know, I was going to ask, like, what made you want to do this, aside from the fact that you are working with one of the greatest directors in the world, with a terrific script, with a starring role, you know, aside from that, is there anything that you, that drew you to it?
What else did I need after that?
Right.
I'd known Philip from New York, you know, we'd done a couple of movies together and did
Capote, which we didn't even talk
Capote about. And Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and then we also did an evening of one-act plays with the drama department off Broadway years and years ago, so, and he is who he is. I think he's the greatest actor my generation. So
after Lovitz.
Yeah, after Lovitz. So the script is beautiful. There are four richly drawn characters and shot and set in New York City, and it's just a beautiful love story.
Okay. Why did he decide to? I mean, it's a wonderful piece of directing too, and this is his first film as a director, and presumably he'll do more. But what made him decide on this?
John Ortiz, who also stars in the film, happens to be Phil's best friend. They both founded the Labyrinth Theater Company. And John is a real instigator in the best sense. So they were sitting around talking about it one day, and he said, you should direct it. And Phil, no. But he had planted that seed, and suddenly Phil just couldn't get it out of his head. So Phil said he started dreaming about it and ways in which, because it had started as a play, he started envisioning it cinematically, and he couldn't stop thinking about it. So it was really just John simply demanding he do it. That's how it came about.
And I do want to just ask you a little bit about what else you're doing, because I know you've shot episodes of In Treatment.
The
HBO series.
The third season of In Treatment, by Gabriel Byrne's new therapist, which will air this fall. And then I'm going to go back to The Office for a few more.
Oh, great. So mixing it up.
Yeah, mixing it up. Yes. I try.
Okay, well, we can't wait to see all your other films and plays and TV shows and whatever you do. Thanks so much. We're going to take just a very brief break before we start the film, but it's a really beautiful piece of work. So thanks for being with us here tonight.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.